this simple quiz style game really triggered conversations. And those conversations have powerful health benefits, especially around social isolation, which is the number one modifiable risk factor for dementia. As people age, they can start to withdraw and communication gets harder, and all of a sudden social isolation just appears, and that's a fast trigger for dementia. By getting people talking more, that's the impact that we deliver.
Welcome to the Dementia Research Project. I'm Matt DeRay, and in this podcast, I explore the history, innovation, and champions in and around the world of dementia. Bruce Elliott is the CEO and co-founder of Memory Lane Games, an engagement app on a mission to improve the quality of life of those living with dementia all over the world. He has a 20-year track record of building world-class innovative companies across various sectors. Welcome, Bruce. How are you?
Matthew, thank you for having me here. I'm thrilled to chat.
I've been looking forward to this conversation. Digital health applications, it's something I'm extremely curious about, and Memory Lane Games is something that's been on my radar for a while now.
I can tell you a quick story of how we came up with the idea.
That'll be great.
A few years ago, I was sitting in a pub in the Isle of Man, UK, where I live, with a friend of mine, and we were talking about our moms. And his mom at the time was 90 with vascular dementia, and my mom was 86 back in Canada, sharp as a tack. And we were talking about what they both had in common, and it was love of old family photos. And I said, I wonder if we can turn those photos into games. And my friend said, actually, we're turning memories into games. And we started Memory Lane Games the next day. Very simple idea. And we built an app with some quiz style games that are very dementia friendly for our moms. We started building games for our own moms. So our first game was on Vancouver beaches, where my mom's from. What beach is this? Or what was the name of this? And she loved it. And we made a game on Sheffield, where my co-founder's mom was from in the UK. And that was the start.
Fantastic. I'm curious, prior to Memory Lane Games, could you, excuse the pun, take me down memory lane? Because you were involved in some very different sectors, right? From e-commerce to payment, blockchain. So could you share how those experiences almost worked its way up to where you are now?
I started in advertising, doing ads for General Motors in Canada. And then the dot-com boom and the dot-com bust started, and I joined a small startup that we had helped brand his company. It was called High Tech back then. And in effect, the company launched the first cloud computing company and the first app store. 20 years too early, but it was an exciting time. And then I got into online payments, just as online payments were really starting to take off, competing with PayPal. And we built a company that had 1 million users and 250 million a year in revenues. And that's what moved us to the Isle of Man in the UK from Canada. And that company listed on the AIM exchange in London. And then after that, I got into gaming. And then, as you said, blockchain, which was interesting. And I was with president of a company that did the first regulated initial coin offering in the States with Eastman Kodak. So Kodak is our partner. We developed the Kodak coin and the Kodak One image rights management blockchain platform, launched a regulated, fully regulated initial coin offering, which is really popular in Asia at the time. But being a fully regulated blockchain, we realized no one actually wanted a fully regulated blockchain. That regulatory hurdle kind of stalled that company. And that's when I was sitting in a pub talking about our moms. And the next thing, we're developing a digital health app. And that was before we really knew what we started out genuinely building apps for our moms. And then we were at a conference, and a woman heard us speak and said, "Boys, you have no idea what you have here. This app can change lives, and we can prove that in clinical trials." And we're going, we're just making games for our moms. And Helen joined. She had run 8 dementia trials in her career. She's a nurse. She's done R&D for NHS. And she joined us and really ran a clinical trial and grew our company up.
And this was during the period of the pandemic, more or less, right?
Yeah, so we founded the company at the end of 2019, and then first couple months of 2020, we launched, and then COVID hit. But interestingly, our games to engage and play something with your mom or your grandma was needed during the crisis because people were at home with grandma and needed some way to engage and manage that behavior and put smiles on their faces. And our app took off, and we've had 100,000 downloads around the world. Last month, the game's played in 100 countries, including Malaysia.
I've downloaded the app, and I've seen there's so many different categories you have there. What's the most popular category you've observed?
Of course, so it varies by country, but universally, cats and dogs is number one. But in the Philippines, it's Filipino street foods. In India, it's games on deli, for example. In Canada, where I'm from, it's Canadian TV shows is the tops. So it really it changes by country. But everywhere, it's cats and dogs number one. But a lot of our music games are popular because we've got finished the lyrics. So 1960s finished lyrics. Hey, dude, Jude, rude, wooed. And so you play that, but then you start playing a game. Says, what's finished the lyrics of this Beatles song? Hey, blank. And then you have four answers. And as you're going through that process, you're starting to remember about the Beatles. And you might tell a story about seeing the Beatles or hearing the Beatles or the first Beatles or the first record. And all of a sudden you're hearing stories you may not have heard before. And that was the secret that we uncovered, is this simple quiz style game really triggered conversations. And those conversations have powerful health benefits, especially around social isolation, which is the number one modifiable risk factor for dementia in older age. And as people age, they can start to withdraw and communication gets harder. And all of a sudden social isolation just appears. And that's a fast trigger for dementia. By getting people talking more, that's the impact that we deliver.
You mean this sparks conversation between a person with dementia and a caregiver or somebody else if they are in a living facility?
Exactly. So in caregivers, let's take that in the generic term, if that's a family member, if it's an unpaid caregiver, it's a paid caregiver, or it's someone in a care home or in-home care, domiciliary care. So we license our app into each of those applications.
Before the call started, you showed me a link to a Malaysia-focused game. Could you share how it works in terms of selection of countries into your library and topics?
Right. So we have 3,200 games in our app. So on just about every city in India, the Philippines, UK, US, Canada, for example, Uganda, Nigeria. We've worked with national Alzheimer's associations around the world, including in the Philippines. We work very closely with the Alzheimer's Disease Association of the Philippines, and they helped us with their neurologists, clinicians, nurses, memory cafe workers to build content. So we started building games. So we have 250 games on the Philippines. So most cities, but we have games on OPM, original Filipino music. We've got games on Filipino street foods, all of those kind of things. But what we do is we've got games on just about every major city in the world. So no matter where you grew up, we say, oh, where did you grow up? Oh, I grew up in KL. Huh, great. Let's see if there's a game on KL. You search that and you start playing a game. There's very familiar, simple questions, but beautiful pictures. And it's the beautiful pictures that start to trigger that memory, and that leads to the conversations. So we're all about socialization, not scoring.
One of the really interesting features I saw was the whole personalization aspect of this, with persons with dementia, their own personal pictures or videos. Could you share how that works?
Sure. So it's one of our features, and you can submit photos and questions and then quickly create your own game. So if who's standing next to Uncle Jim at the wedding, or where was this holiday spot we used to go to, all of those kinds of things to really trigger those positive memories. But what we're finding is the games on the cities, because we've got such extensive coverage, we've got games on just about every hobby, from woodworking tools and gardening and bird watching and all these kind of things localized for each country, that we've got an amazing selection that people can find. And after you play a game, you rate it, you say, I liked it or it wasn't for me. And then we recommend three more games with our algorithms. And But 70% of the gameplay is from those three that we recommend based on what you've played and liked, and also accuracy and things like that that we monitor.
Speaking of personalization, how do you think of that with regards to persons of dementia who play your game but who are at different stages?
Yep.
Is there like settings that make it different? How does that work?
So that's a great question, because we've had a Goldilocks challenge. Some people find the games too easy. Some people find the games too hard. And so finding that right sweet spot is something that we're developing AI for right now. So a dynamic degree of difficulty in critical flow state is what they call it. So it's adjusting the difficulty over time. And so we're just going through that process right now. But our algorithms today learn what games you like and how the accuracy was, which tells us, did you get it right on the first try or the second try, third try? Those kind of things give us an indication, and then we serve up appropriate games for that. But we think, again, ours is a little different, that it's not so much about getting questions right. If you touch an answer in our multiple choice and it's wrong, it just gently disappears. It doesn't tell you did anything wrong. And we did that to make our moms happy so we didn't upset them. But working with our partners at the Mayo Clinic, they said, that's errorless learning. That's fundamental to stroke rehab. That's amazing, because you're not frustrating people. And that was always our priority, was frustration-free.
And that frustration-free, I suppose, is such a key insight, which only a developer who's had that personal experience would understand.
Yeah, our user experience was designed by a 19-year-old whose grandma was going through dementia. And we still use that same UX today. And it was really designed, our frustration-free is our focal point. And the Mayo Clinic described us as simple yet scalable. Simple is hard when you really try and strip it back and keep it really simple. So we don't have ads. We don't have music blaring. We don't have all of these other things. We just try and keep it simple so that we can allow that processing time to start to trigger memories and foster improved communications.
You mentioned you're in 100 countries. How does that work in terms of distribution? How do you get the word out and find these different people?
Almost zero marketing, which is amazing. We've had 100,000 downloads. We've had over 1.6 million minutes of gameplay across 134 countries now. And we started with partnerships with National Alzheimer's Association. So we did a launch with the Alzheimer's Disease Association of the Philippines. Their neurologists were using our app, we didn't even know, in over telemedicine during COVID. So they would log in on an iPad into Zoom. Then they would log into the open ILMN, the Memory Lane Games app. And then their caregiver remotely would log into on an iPad, would log into Zoom, and they would play the games. They would share the screen and play the games. So we learned from our partners like that. But the Philippines, we had 25,000 downloads in the first couple months, supported by the National Alzheimer's Association. We did the same in Uganda, and we did a lot of work in India. So we've got extensive content for each of those countries. And that's what we first said, would you like a free localized dementia app? And National Alzheimer's Association put their hands up and said, yeah, that'd be great. There's some countries that we worked a bit in Malaysia as well. Countries like Indonesia were really interesting, because we were talking to the National Alzheimer's Associations and they said there's a lot of stigma with dementia. They said it was almost you're touched by the devil or something if you get dementia. And it wasn't, or they thought it was just a normal part of aging. It wasn't thought of as a condition. And so they wanted to use our app to help, because it's not called Alzheimer's Day or Dementia Day or things like that. So we break that stigma, because you're not playing a dementia game, right? You're just enjoying an activity with family members that has benefits.
And this truly is the power of digital health, right? Especially in low resource environments who maybe don't have memory clinics in more rural areas.
That's another reason why we made the game so that they work offline as well. So once you've downloaded the app at your house and then you go visit grandma who may not have Wi-Fi, you can still play the games and she can play her favorite games, and makes those visits so much more productive. But yeah, that's the power of digital health. Is we have an app, we can deliver it all over the world with just a few clicks and for pennies compared to the latest Alzheimer's drugs that cost $26,000 a year that are going to never get available in all of the smaller countries, developing nations. And we don't think that's fair. And so we think this is a great equalizer. And I think that's the power of digital health, is it can be done right. It can be very inexpensive therapy that's delivered to all.
If you think about games like Candy Crush, Wordle, that habit forming is built into its DNA. For something like this, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. For us, habit is a good thing because the repetition, the familiarity, the comfort in our audience of people with Alzheimer's and dementia is very important. But we're not focused on number of games played. We're more focused on the conversations. And I think that's a big difference from how we approach this kind of model. And we've had some great clinical results. We ran a clinical trial in the UK that showed the caregivers loved us, which we think is really important. Taking better care of caregivers helps take better care of people with dementia. So 92% of the caregivers were more relaxed when playing. They were 83% said the person with dementia was laughing more, and 67% said the caregivers were happier. And then 58% of the caregivers said that the person with dementia was communicating more. And that was music to our ears and really reinforced what we're all about.
I'm so glad you said that. I think media and digital media, it's almost a different lens, right? How do you get people on and keep them on? It's almost like that treadmill. And I'm so glad that the lens here is very person with dementia focused.
But let me give you a different industry example of digital health, which I think is fascinating. I don't know if you ever played Star Wars video games or Medal of Honor. So the fellows who made those games at Lucasfilms left Lucasfilms and joined a digital health startup. And they decided to make video games for ADHD. And so they took all of the brain power, all of their knowledge of how to create dopamine, how to engage, all of those things that you've experienced playing those games, and turned it around to reward focus in very precise ways in a video game. But they limit the game to 25 minutes a day. That's all you can play. But they had incredible clinical results that showed that this works for extending focus well beyond while you're playing the game. So there's some really interesting things happening in digital health. There's another example. I don't know how well you sleep, but there's an app called Sleepio, which was started by a university professor and one of his psychology students at Cambridge. And the student was an insomniac and said, there's got to be a way that we can do something with an app. And so they made an app that had a narcoleptic dog that helped you fall asleep. And they built it and they started using it. It was going great. Then they ran some clinical trials. It was going great. And just recently, the NHS bought 1 million prescriptions of their app to give to every insomniac in the UK. It is that. It's better, cheaper, and safer than non-addictive than sleeping pills. So there's some wonderful success stories in digital health. But I think, again, keeping that, our focus is being able to keep it accessible around the world. So because you can, it's like pharma, the first pill costs $1 billion, the next pill costs a penny. But trying to find, with digital health, you don't need to spend $1 billion.
And do things like clinical trials just beef up that proof of validation that can just help mass adoption?
So it's comfort. You look at the internet, you look at Facebook, everything. How do you know wellness is such a big category? How do you know what to pick? And I think that our work with the Mayo Clinic is such a big power brand in the space. We're right now working with the Texas Medical Center, done work with the NHS, BUPA. So you need that kind of credibility because there's so much out there that, in our view, people talk about brain training, and there's apps with 200 million downloads and 50 million subscribers. And But that does absolutely nothing for dementia. And that's been documented by Stanford neuroscientists. 100 of them wrote a letter saying that this does absolutely nothing. Playing Sudoku every day does nothing. For us, the focus on socialization was the big leap. So it's not, again, it's not about getting the scoring right. It's about the socialization. And that's our focus. And that's a little different than what most people seem to focus. All we need to do is get more people talking. But that's hard, and really harder as dementia progresses.
Are there any anecdotal stories from residential senior care facilities, especially where there's almost a peer group, right? Yeah.
Share a couple of stories with you. One is about a fellow named Colin. So we were at a memory cafe put on by one of the football clubs in England. And they brought their fans with dementia come in for a day, and they get served coffee and such, and the caregivers just get to break. They get to hang around the outsides. And it's a wonderful experience for the individuals, but also a wonderful break for the caregivers. And at each of the tables, we have one of our iPads with our games. And at our table, we're introduced to Colin. They said, Colin's pretty much nonverbal, but he'll probably enjoy this. Great. Colin sits down, grabs the iPad, flicks through, picks our Finish the Lyrics 1960s game. He's flicking through and he's humming, and then he gets to this one question about, it's got a picture of Elvis and Roy Orbison in the photo. And he looks over and says, Roy Orbison's a way better singer than Elvis. And we're going, yes, of course, you're absolutely right. I agree. He goes, but Elvis had a better manager. And we're going, yes. And he starts humming and he's playing the game and he's just enjoying it. We found something he wanted to talk about, and that's the magic. But later, just at the end of that session, we're cleaning up the iPads, and there's a woman over in the corner crying. I'm like, gosh. And we go over, is everything okay? And she goes, yes, I've been looking after Colin for 3 months. I've never heard him complete a sentence. That is the power of something like this. I'll give you another example. A nurse in a care home uses our app to distract patients as they're escalating behavior, especially later in the afternoon. There's a condition called sundowning where people with dementia often become more agitated and a little more difficult. And so every night, this one woman would have a flashback to her childhood. This is a woman with dementia. She's about 85. And she would flashback to an abusive moment in her childhood every night. Terrible for her, terrible for the staff as well. Just imagine this. During the day, this nurse introduces our app and they start playing, and they play our cats and dogs game, one of our most popular games in the world. And it turns out her dog that she had as a kid was featured in the game. So one of the questions, and every evening as she was escalating, the nurse would bring that game out for her, and it stopped her escalating into those flashbacks. And they ended up using less antipsychotic drugs over the course of a month, just from finding that one thing that person could connect with. And that's the magic.
Stories like this, it just has to make everything worth it, right?
Yeah. We found that we have benefits for both the person with dementia, but also the caregivers, because they need that support. And they need a tool that's always in their pocket that they can reach in and say, oh, mom, do you remember that game on KL? Why don't we just sit and play that for a second? And all of a sudden, it completely changes the discussion. And I think that is that's what we've been able to find. And we've got 3,000 games in the app. So if you search, you can find just about any place or hobbies or favorite TV shows. All of these kind of things are festivals. Those are there to help those moments when it's really agitation and it's becoming stressful and you're not sure what to do. But we also work with speech and language therapists. And we've got videos in the app of tips on how to engage. And one of the most interesting ones, the speech language pathologist from Boston told us, is when you're sitting with someone, first thing is you don't ask them a question. You don't say, would you like to play a game? Because the answer is always no in dementia. It's apathy, no. So you say, if you can help me with this, or look at this. And then you start. And then you read the question and you read the answers. And then her advice is shut up. Because what we tend to do is like a cats and dogs game. What's the name of this dog breed? Dad, you remember when we had a dog like that and we used to take it on the walks and blah, blah, blah. And you're just overloading with information. But if you just read the question, read the answers, and then shut up and let the processing run, they'll reach out and touch the answer, and then they're engaged. It's amazing.
That's really interesting. In terms of delivery, it sounds like it's almost like hybrid in the sense that maybe in some situations, the questions are read out and then they interact directly with a device. Have you seen any interesting insights around what works best?
So it's interesting because a lot of our therapy works best when it's talking, right? So just playing on your own isn't as therapeutic, let's say, but it's fun, it's activity. My mom, who's still very sharp, loves to play our crossword puzzle game. So in those moments, it's really designed to talk. But our future development, we're looking at Gen AI chatbots to facilitate that conversation and seeing if we can deliver that same level of engagement. So not only you say, oh, here's what breed of dog is this? It's a golden retriever. Great. Did you have a dog when you were a child? Yes. Oh, wow. What was the dog's name? And did you ever take it? We think the huge leaps in Gen AI will allow us to do that maybe next year. I still like the person-to-person contact. I think that's what delivers the benefits for both. But there are times when you just might need to say, Mom, why don't you and Sally, the bot, play for a minute while I cook dinner?
I was going to ask, my next question on the list was, what are you most excited about? I think you've answered that already. And I suppose it speaks to the general excitement around Gen AI in terms of the possibilities.
We're already using Gen AI in game creation because we use royalty-free photos so we can keep the costs low. And yeah, we've got 100,000 photos in the app now. And in places where we can't find photos on or themes we can't find, we were making a game on a Yorkshire rugby club. So in England, a particular rugby club the other day, somebody had requested that. But we couldn't find an image from the 60s, so we used Gen AI. It'd give us a picture of a Yorkshire rugby club in this area in the 1960s, familiar to people with dementia, and something where I could almost smell the grass. And it came back 30 seconds later with a spectacular picture. There's ways for us to accelerate our game development, to personalize it even further, and to really pull those heartstrings. So Gen AI has got some real magic for us.
You mentioned you worked with the Alzheimer's Foundation of Philippines.
Yeah.
How do you think about accessibility? And because I know you have a free trial, right? Do you think about it differently in markets that can afford it versus maybe can't afford it?
Yeah. So Philippines and India, because we, and Uganda, where we worked with the National Alzheimer's Associations, we keep it free. So if there's groups who step up and help us, so National Alzheimer's Associations or volunteer groups, then we're happy to keep it free in those countries. We haven't figured out how to monetize that. And so it really, every month we have thousands of users from India and the Philippines, and that remains free. But we're figuring that out. It's our desire. I'd love to find a way to make it free for everyone all the time. Haven't figured that out yet. We still have to pay our bills. But that's how we started. We wanted this to be free. Look, you can deliver 1 million users for $1,000 a month. It costs nothing. So it should. Now you got the team cost. That's just the technical cost, right? You got the team cost. You got the people. All these other things that add up. But this is the power of digital health. It should be able to be delivered to anyone. Because again, getting it down onto Android smartphones where you download it either at school or at university or at home, and then you go and see your grandma, whether she's in a care home or living at home, you can play those games. And I think we think that's awesome. So it's interesting. We're building games. We're working with the Arizona Hispanic Chamber of Commerce right now and to localize the games in Spanish. But what they want us to do is build more and more games on little cities and towns in Mexico, where grandma's from. And that will trigger the positive memories for her. That's really easy for us. So just finding a partner who can guide us and help us, that's what we really want to do.
I certainly hope this podcast helps. And I hope folks, when they listen to this, they can reach out. What's the best way to reach out to you, Bruce?
Here to help at memorylanegames.com. send us an email, and we'll, if you have a volunteer group or a National Alzheimer's Association or care homes, let us know and we'd love to help. And the other thing is you can play our games all over the world, in every country. It is available. We've got games, like you said, we've got a game on Malaysia, a game on KL. We've got Indian street foods and Filipino street foods and this and that. But also, if you have game ideas for us, you can send those through as well too. Here to help@memorylanegames.com. Great.
Is there anything I maybe should have asked but didn't ask yet, Bruce?
You talked about evidence-based apps before. That's very important to us. So we're looking for more and more partners anywhere in the world who are interested in running clinical trials with us and real-world evidence, not just formal clinical trials, to show that there is benefit in playing our games. And I think that this structured cognitive stimulation therapy that's triggering positive memories, both visual, emotional, with fine motor skills, all of these things wrapped up together with socialization is so important in addressing cognitive decline. And cognitive decline and dementia is estimated to be nearly tripling the number of cases worldwide by 2050. And much of that's in the developing world where people are living longer. And so I think these things we're going to see this more and more. But another thing we've heard is social isolation is a huge barrier, is a huge, I think, a condition. And solving social isolation where grandma and grandpa or they stop talking, that's when you really need an intervention. And to me, finding that game on their hometown or their favorite hobby or their favorite interest or their favorite music, favorite foods, all of those things are just such an easy way to overcome that. And to me, we all need to spend more time on addressing that social isolation. It happens, and the behavior becomes more challenging, and so the family or caregivers can withdraw, and then it just accelerates, and I think we need to solve that, the mission we're on.
So there's this term, social prescribing.
Yeah.
How do you think about fitting it into that?
So there's been a lot of talk of that in the UK and others. We're really excited about social prescribing, because we're so easy to prescribe, right? It's an app from the App Store. And we have two apps, Memory Lane Games Pro as well. That's our clinical app that has a code and can be distributed then for free. So health systems who are interested in that can partner with us, and then we can distribute that app for free in countries. And we think that's powerful. I think we're open to partnerships if any groups around the world are interested. We stayed away from music for two reasons. One, everyone says, oh, you should have songs and everything. First, the music rights are incredibly expensive, and I'm cheap and frugal. But also, the music, our speech-language therapists were telling us, gets in the way of conversation. So they're singing, or toe-tapping, but they're not conversing. And so we're focused on that conversation. But partnering with any of those groups, CST, music therapy, everything, because we're quite focused in our cognitive stimulation socialization, we think that can be a really good fit. We'd welcome those conversations.
Great. This has been a really insightful discussion, Bruce.
No, thank you. This is important for us because we want to be all over the world. And your Southeast Asia audience, your interest in playing the game on KL that we talked about, our solution really works everywhere. Getting the word out is what we need, and we really appreciate the enthusiasm and the genuine interest. It's wonderful.
Great. Thanks, Bruce. Thanks for listening. If you want more of these type of stories, interviews, and guests, please follow the Dementia Research Project wherever you get your podcasts. Onwards and upwards.